Wake up, America. Time to stump the experts. Each week at this time, H.J. Heinz Company, makers of the 57 varieties, give you information, please. A quartet of experts is on hand to answer your questions. Send them to Information Please at 570 Lexington Avenue, New York 22, New York. We may edit them a bit, and in case of similarity, you'll have to accept our judgment of who shall be paid. Please note that if this year we use your question, which is postmarked any time between now and December 31st, you will get not the usual $10 in war stamps, but a $50 war bond, plus a set of the 12-volume Britannica Junior Encyclopedia. If we muff the question, you get in addition $57 in war bonds and stamps, plus a 24-volume set of the regular Encyclopedia Britannica. All questions remain our property. Information, Please, is presented under the supervision of Dan Golenpaul. And now, our master of ceremonies, Clifton Fadiman.
Ladies and gentlemen, Information, Please, unrehearsed as usual, continues on its carefree path, the Care Freedom tonight being supplied from coast to coast by our stout veteran trio, Franklin P. Adams, Oscar Levant, and the New York Sun's bright ray, John Curran. Our guest is the author of the famous bestseller, A Tree Grows in Brooklyn, Miss Betty Smith. But before we go into our little act, I owe $57 in war bonds, an encyclopedia, and a handsome apology to James Ritchie of Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts, for an error that I made last week in connection with his question about detectives. Very good question. I allowed the experts to get by on two parts out of three after announcing that all three parts were required. So that's another $57 from Mr. Morgenthau's treasury and a Britannica to Mr. Ritchie. Now, how about beginning with a question from Frieda Weinshaw? You'll be delighted to know that she is from Brooklyn, Miss Smith. Brooklyn, New York. How about this? What was the significance of each of these slogans? The first is, wait till next year. Wait till next year. Mr. Curran.
Well, that used to be a battle cry in Brooklyn as well as many other major National League cities. That we didn't win the pennant this year, but wait till next year.
Yes. And is it the particular property of the Dodgers, do you think?
Well, they made it popular. They've made a lot of things popular.
And vice versa. Popular. Mr. Levant?
They will need that slogan again.
Gee, the dark prophecy. I'm surprised you don't swat him, Miss Smith. Or aren't you a Dodger fan, Miss Smith?
Why, of course, but I know that they'll come back next year.
Well, that settles you, Mr. Levant. They'll come back next year. How about this one? Pike's Peak or Bust? What did that slogan mean? Oh, Pike's Peak or Bust? Miss Smith?
I think that was the Gold Rush slogan. Wasn't it?
The gold hunters in Colorado, yes. Mr. Curran?
Well, one slogan that it was about 40 years ago, or perhaps a little less, was the automobile testing. They used to, there was a hill climbing contest
at
Pike's Peak.
Yes. But as Miss Smith reminded us, it does go back to an earlier day, to 1850.
Well, a little
when
before
doing mining
my day.
In Colorado.
No.
Much before Miss Smith's. How about this slogan, Tomorrow the World? What does that mean to any of you, Mr. Levant?
That was a man whose name almost escapes me, Hitler. He said today to Europe and tomorrow the world.
Well, we don't know whether it was Hitler who said it, though no doubt he meant it. It's a song written by a German, Hans Baumann. Today we rule Germany, tomorrow the world.
He doesn't belong to ASCAP, that song.
And I hope you'll never let him in. How about, how did the phrase get its popularity recently, Mr. Levant?
Through propaganda, and then there was a book, I think.
Through the play.
There's a play, Tomorrow the World. A little boy plays a Nazi.
Yes, quite right. Well, that gives us 3 out of 3. Try this one, but I'm going to ask you to get all on this because I think it's much easier. This is from Jerome Balton. By golly, another Brooklyn boy. What are children learning to spell when they say, chicken on the car? Chicken on the car? Has none of you had a childhood, Mr. Curran?
Chicken on a car can't go. Chicago, isn't it?
That's right.
That's the way to spell Chicago.
That's right.
What happened to you, Adams?
That was after my time.
Now, suppose children say a rhyme beginning, knife and a fork. Mr. Adams.
That we had in Chicago.
How does that
and
go?
And a bottle and a cork, and that's the way to spell New York.
Oh, boy, Mr. Adams. Very good. Now, suppose they say, capital C, O, Anaconi, Sisaconi, Tan, Tan, T, Mr. Adams.
Yes.
That spells Constantinople.
Atta boy. Now, where would you find that?
I don't know.
Mr. Curran.
It has disappeared and is now called Istanbul.
Istanbul.
Well, the phrase, the little jingle, got renewed popularity a couple of years ago because it's, I think it appears in Mr. Krause and Mr. Lindsay's play, Life with Father. Doesn't one of the boys...
No, H.U. Uckel.
Well, I'm not sure. Maybe it's H.U. Uckel.
H.U. Uckelberry Pie.
H.U. Uckelberry Pie, I think you're quite right. Wait, I knew there was some rhyme of that sort. Here's one from Otto W. Kuhlman of Pittsburgh, California, and it's a musical question. Better get 2 out of 3. You are to identify the tune from the scale which is prominent in each. Just the scale is going to be played. Is that clear? Let's have the first. I had Mr. Levant's hand at once.
Chopin Mazurka.
Chopin Mazurka. Very good. Is that hard to do, Miss Smith? Seems
yes.
hard to me.
Not if you've played it for 20 years.
Maybe the second will be harder. Mr. Levant again.
It's a Beethoven violin concerto in D major.
How many years have you played that?
I've heard it for 20 years.
Gee, I'd love to stick you, Oscar. Let's have the third.
A little bit more. That isn't enough.
No, that's all you get. That's the scale.
Let him do it again.
Mr. Curran.
That might be Grieg in the Hall of the
Mountain King.
That's right. Mm-hmm. How long have you played that, Mr. Curran?
40 years.
Good work. Now try this one from William E. Walter of New York City. I suppose he means Manhattan, one of the minor boroughs, Miss Smith. Who was the man who discarded or abandoned each of these females? The first female is Tess. Who about Mr. Levant?
Constant Nymph. Before Charles Boyer, Louis Dodd.
I never read the book. I don't know.
He abandons Tess.
He does abandon
Tess. For money, for a woman with money.
There's another person who abandons Tess. She seems to be a thoroughly abandoned woman. Mr. Curran?
That was Tess of the Derbyvilles.
That's right. And who did the abandoning?
Thomas Hardy. The
Angel somebody.
Angel is right. Angel what?
I can't.
Angel Clare. Angel Clare.
Right.
Well, among the three of you, I should think we got a correct
answer.
You got two Tesses. How about this? Who abandoned Little Emily? Little Emily. Mr. Curran.
Steerforth.
And where would you find that?
You'd find that in David Copperfield.
Yes, very touching story. How about the abandonment of a lady named Michaela? Michaela, Mr. Levant.
Oh, Don Jose.
That's right. Where did you find that abandonment?
In Carmen.
In Carmen. Very good. The wits are working brilliantly this evening, Miss Smith and gentlemen. How about this one from Miss M.J. Spears of Dedham, Massachusetts? And I think we should get 2 out of 3. Here's the situation. Suppose you saw these articles on a table. What would be going on? The first set of articles is a bottle of swabs, a bottle of mineral oil, and a bar of Castile soap.
Oh.
Miss Smith.
A baby would be getting a bath.
Yes, that's right, quite right. A baby would be getting a bath. Now, suppose
it's
you saw...
Easy.
It's not easy. You ever bathe a baby?
Well, I bathed 2 of them in my time.
Very hard, I know that.
Mr. Levant has bathed 2 in his time, too.
1.5.
A long time, too. Now, suppose you saw these articles on a table. A pair of tweezers, a packet of hinges... Package of hinges, a reading glass.
I think that would have something to do with stamps.
That's quite right.
Collecting stamps.
You apparently have bathed the stamp collection, too. That's quite right. Ready to pay stamps and an album. He'd need those 3 things. And now, finally, we have on the table a bottle of Worcestershire sauce, a bottle of tomato ketchup, the yolk of an egg, vinegar, and pepper. What's going on? Miss Smith again.
That's before the morning after the night before.
That's right. Yeah. You care to tell us any more, Miss Smith?
No, I just I saw A Star Is Born, and I know that Frederick March ordered something like that after he had been out on a terrific binge the night before.
Mr. Adams?
Sounds like fun in the Heinz plant.
Heinz for hangovers. Mr.
It's
Levant.
Good for salad dressing. You don't have to get drunk for that.
Worcestershire sauce, tomato ketchup, yolk of an egg, vinegar, and pepper. Sure, you could use it for some sort
on
of salad.
On any train.
Dressing.
Well, without the egg, though.
Quite possible. And now our Heinz reporter, Ben Grauer, seems to be lost in a nostalgic reverie tonight. What fond recollections on your mind, Ben?
Well, days like these, when dusk comes early and there's a sweet, smoky aroma of smoldering bonfires in the air, I always remember hustling down our village street about supper time, the smell of other people's dinners spurring me on to our own kitchen door. And like as not, there'd be a big kettleful of tomato soup on the stove, sending forth little clouds of fragrant steam. It was a perfect soup on a chilly evening, just as Heinz condensed cream of tomato soup is today. There's a kind of a glow to Heinz cream of tomato soup that's as inviting as a hearty smile. Rich and red with the juices of fine tomatoes, thick and delicious with honest-to-goodness cream, that's real cream of tomato soup, the way Heinz makes it. Only the finest, ripest tomatoes are used. Aristocrats, we call them, because they're the most flavorful tomatoes that can be grown. And they're rushed right from the vines to Heinz kitchens to lend their garden-fresh goodness to the soup kettles. These days, when it takes a lot of planning to set a good table for your family, remember that Heinz condensed cream of tomato soup goes a long way toward making even a skimpy meal appetizing and filling and downright delicious.
Thank you, Ben Grauer. And now we'll go on with a question from Bernard Backer of Philadelphia. In poetry or song, what was wanted by someone who didn't want the following? Someone didn't want marmalade. What did he want instead? Mr. Adams.
Butter on his bread.
Who was it?
I guess
I'm not a very fussy man.
King.
That's right. The king who wasn't, as Mr. Smith reminds us, a very fussy man. Quite. In A.A. Milne's poem. Now, what was wanted by someone who didn't want to get well? He didn't want to get well.
Oh, he wanted the beautiful nurse. I don't want to get well because I'm in love with a beautiful nurse.
That's right. That's right. That goes rather... That's rather before your time, though, isn't it, that song, Miss Smith?
No.
You haven't been picking Mr. Adams' memory.
No.
Yes, it's the song, I Don't Want to Get Well, I Don't Want to Get Well, I'm in Love with a Beautiful Nurse. And what was wanted by someone who did not want to set the world on fire?
Oh, I don't want to set the world on fire. I just want to... Now I'm stuck, but it's
Mr.
just Levant to be first in your heart.
You want to ignite a flame in her heart or something. Something incendiary like that.
Some pyromaniacal ambition. Want to start a flame in your heart. Yes, from the popular song. Try this one from Mrs. William K. Payne of Newtown, Connecticut, and get 2 out of 3. What is the association between Jedediah Smith and Francis Parkman? They have something in common. Mr. Adams.
Historians.
No, though it's a brilliant guess.
Parkman wrote about the...
Miss Smith, can you help out, Mr. Adams?
The Mormon Trail.
Well, not the Mormon Trail so much.
The Oregon Trail.
Famous Oregon Trail. And what did Jedediah Smith have to do with the Oregon Trail? Well, it was rediscovered by him in 1824, and it was as the result of Jedediah's explorations that it became very famous. And then in 1846, Francis Parkman, the great historian, re-traveled over it and wrote an American classic.
Where does Marcus Whitman come in there?
Before that. Wasn't he a member of that Astor fur trading expedition?
No, he and his wife were missionaries, and they went out, and I thought he was the first one to open up the Oregon Trail.
Well, I know that Jedediah Smith was the second one, or perhaps even the third, Mr. Levant.
It was easier to get reservations in those days.
You mean the Indians had them?
I'll have to call that one wrong. And we have to get the next two right. What's the association between the Duke of Wellington and Lord Byron? Mr. Levant.
They were both English.
Not enough.
One had a limp. One wore high boots. One died in Greece. I don't know then.
You've exhausted
this. Oh, he wrote a poem about Wellington.
Yes. Who did?
Ode to Napoleon.
Yes.
You're getting things mixed up.
But I got there.
Mr. Curran?
I know.
There was sound of revelry by night. That's right. Poem, the connection between them, because that was the night before the Battle of Waterloo.
Yes.
The poem was written by Byron, and the Duke of Wellington won the battle with a little help from Blücher or Blücher.
Yes. Now, does that clear you up, Mr. Levant?
Except that he did write a poem called Ode to Napoleon.
Yes, but that's kind of far-fetched, because of the Wellington...
I withdraw in dismay.
I'll have to mark that wrong. And now we get the next one, which is the association between Robinson Crusoe and Alexander Selkirk. What is the association? Mr. Adams.
Alexander Selkirk was alone on Juan Fernandez Island.
Was he a real man?
Yes.
He was. Very true. And what's that got to do with Robinson Crusoe?
Well, Robinson Crusoe was not a real man, and he was Alexander... About Alexander... Selkirk was written, "I am monarch of all I survey."
Yeah. Well, and, the association...
Robinson Crusoe was the fictional...
That's right.
...Selkirk.
Yes, that's right. The idea of Robinson Crusoe is inspired by the true story of Alexander Selkirk. Well, we got only one out of three on that, and that sends $57 in war bonds and stamps to Mrs. Payne and a set of the Britannica. And sends us on to this question from June Ling of Detroit. This, again, is a musical question divided into three parts. Get two out of three. The selections you're going to hear bear the same name as a dance craze. Can you tell within 3 years, either way, when each was popular? This is a matter of dating the dance. Let's have the first. I have Mr. Levant's hand at once.
Charleston.
And what'd you date it for us?
Around 24.
24, but just about within the limit. It was 27, the height of its popularity, and that's within 3 years.
It was in a show called Running Wild, which played the Colonial Theater. And I remember I paid my rent in 1924.
What a memory. Now the second. Mr. Levant again.
Lambeth Walk.
Lambeth Walk, very good. Now, when was it popular?
36 or 37 or 38.
Very good.
Yeah.
That's right. Well, 37, the height of its popularity in England, and in this country a year or so later.
Still popular in Leon and Eddie's, I think. I don't know.
And now the third and last.
Oh. About 19.
Miss Smith?
14.
You're just in the limit, yes. What's the dance?
Everybody's doing it.
Yes, I don't know what the dance
Turkey
is
Trot.
Turkey Trot, that's it.
And, Mr. Kieran, what were you going to tell us? Irving
Berlin wrote it.
And in 1911, it was the height of its popularity. You said 1914?
Yes, that's when
enough.
I heard it.
Three out of three. But you just get in on the tail end of it, Smith. How about this one from Stephen Bernstein of New York City? This is about mice, if you don't mind, Miss Smith. Identify the mouse that was kept in a pocket... A mouse that was kept in a pocket. Mr. Adams.
That would be in Steinbeck's book.
Right.
That's right.
Mice and Men.
Very
oh,
good,
yes.
Mm. That's dredging
Lenny.
It out.
Lenny.
Yes, kept in Lenny's pocket, one of the characters in Steinbeck's famous short novel of Mice and Men, which was made into a play and also a movie, I think.
There was one in my grandmother's pocket once.
Well, why didn't you tell us that, Miss Smith? Don't keep these things to yourself. Identify the mouse that was wooed by a frog. Mr. Kieran.
That was the froggy wood, a wooing go, hi-o, says Rowley, whether his mother would let him or no. And, pray, Mrs. Mouse, are you within? That's what he said when he knocked on the door. Party was rudely interrupted later on.
He's better than Winchell. How about the mouse that had a sweetheart? Mouse and spouse. Mr. Levant.
Miss Levant. Mickey Mouse.
Mickey Mouse? Yes. What's the sweetheart's name?
Minnie Mouse.
Yes, yeah. Minnie Mouse. Very good. I guess that was too easy. How about this one from Mrs. Homer Baldwin of Struthers, Ohio? What variety of bird would you find on a golf course? This is, of course, a trick question. Mr. Adams.
A birdie.
Well, what variety of bird?
Just birdie.
Well, that isn't a variety. Mr. Adams.
The name is Kieran.
Mr. Kieran, I beg your pardon.
Well, you might, if you were very lucky and closed your eyes when you swung, you might find an eagle.
What is an eagle?
Well, an eagle would be two under par for the hole.
Yes. I should think that would be a good answer. Mr. Kieran, would you accept Bob O'Link's, maybe?
There's a golf course named the Bob O'Link.
Is there really? Mm-hmm. What variety of bird would you find in the theater?
Oh.
Miss Smith.
The Bronx cheer.
That's not a bird. Oh, yes, it is.
Yeah.
A real rather than a metaphorical bird.
Yeah. Yes.
Mr. Kieran, Mr. Levant.
Miss Levant. Do you mean the name of a play?
Gee, you changed sex visibly, friend.
The Spread Eagle? You mean a play like that?
No. What but a mean? Certain kind of play is often given the name of a famous bird, Mr. Kieran.
A turkey.
A turkey,
oh,
yes. A flop. Found in the wings,
I
doubtless.
Should know.
How about the bird that you'd find in the British forces? You'd find there's a bird in the British forces.
You mean one in the hand over there?
No. The Women's Royal Naval Service have a name. I'm afraid I'm giving it to you.
Oh, the Wren.
Wren.
Yes, but I'm afraid I gave that to you. Well, we did get two out of three on that. The other day, I ran across a newspaper article that should interest our Heinz reporter, Ben Grauer. They made a survey, Ben, of what soldiers go for at chow time, and soup is right up there on top.
And that's just what I've been saying all along. A deep-down, honest hankering for real old-fashioned soup is second nature to man and boy. Not the thin, pale variety, mind you, but full-bodied, thick and flavorful soup like Heinz Cream of Tomato. Now, there's a soup that looks and smells and tastes just like the kind your grandma used to cook up for her hungry men folks. Like her recipe, Heinz Cream of Tomato Soup calls for and gets plenty of thick, rich cream mixed in with the rich puree of plump, vine-ripened tomatoes. Another secret of Heinz Cream of Tomato Soup is the seasoning. Just the right touch of subtle spices to point up the fresh tomato flavor. You can't tell what those spices are. You just know that Heinz Cream of Tomato Soup tastes wonderful. There's age-old wisdom, painstaking care, and patience in the making of Heinz Cream of Tomato Soup, and appetizing goodness that's hard to describe, but truly easy to eat.
Thank you, Ben Grauer. And now how about this one from Mrs. Deve and Emden of Seattle, Washington. What would you have if you followed these poetical recipes? The first is, melt them all down in a pipkin or crucible. That is, of course, a quotation, a verse quotation. Mr. Adams.
That is from The Pirates of Penzance, I think.
You got the right authors all right, but the wrong opera.
You want a receipt for that?
Yeah.
Popular mystery, I think.
It's from Patience.
It's Patience, that's
And
right.
What do you get when you melt them all down in a pipkin or crucible? Set them to simmer and take off the scum. What do you
and
get?
And a heavy dragoon is the residuum.
That's right. The heavy dragoon is the residuum. Now, what would you have if this were the recipe? Frogs and snails and puppy dogs' tails.
Bouillie base.
Mr. Curran.
That's what little boys are made of.
Yes, and it's a libel. How about this? Fillet of a fenny snake in the cauldron, boil and bake. Miss Smith?
That's from Macbeth, and you'd have a charm so that you'd be famous after a while.
Well, what were they actually baking in
there?
You
have a witch's brew.
Yes, you'd have a witch's brew from the witch's brew and the...
A dry brew, incidentally.
Very. Do you remember how the recipe goes on, Mr. Curran? Do you?
No, it's too mixed up.
Very nasty little affair. Eye of newt and tongue of dog, adder's fork and blind worm's sting.
And thumb of...
All unrationed, as a matter of fact. Try this one from James Anderson of Buffalo. Name the character of fiction who sought vengeance because he didn't get paid. He wasn't paid, and as a result, took his revenge. Famous character. Mr. Curran?
Jean Valjean wasn't paid, but he didn't take any great revenge.
I'm thinking of the Pied Piper of Hamelin.
Oh,
remember,
yeah.
His job was to get rid of the rats. He did it, and they refused to pay him. And, Mr. Curran, what revenge did he take?
He took away all the children except one lame boy.
Yes, that's right. One wrong on that. Now we have to get the next two right. What character sought vengeance because he spurned her advances? A man who...
Who sought revenge in that case?
Let's see. The lady sought the revenge.
Is that Salome?
That's right. Very good.
Two men there. That's very confused, Salome. It's like that case we were reading about.
It is a tough case.
Huh? Well, I'll tell it to you. John the Baptist and Herod the king.
John, or Yochanan, is the one I was thinking of.
But he spurned the woman.
Yes, he spurned her. That's what I said.
But she spurned her own stepfather. I didn't want to mention it.
Oh, it happened a long time ago, Mr. Levant. It's all right. Miss Smith, what are you going to help us
out? Could you say Frankie and Johnny?
Frankie and Johnny? How would you say, Mr. Levant, that was right?
They were more direct in their revenge.
Very good. I think that Mr. Levant's answer covers the case exactly. What character or characters of fiction or plays sought vengeance because they stole his eye?
Oh.
Mr. Smith.
A knight at an inn, I think, Lord Dunsany.
Very good.
Guard.
That's
they
right.
They took his eye and they followed him.
That's right. The avenging priest murdered the
yes.
sailors who stole the eye from, the ruby eye from the eye of a god. And that gives us 2 out of 3. Try this one. Again, a 2 out of 3 question from Oliver Dean of Scarsdale, New York. This is all about characters named Jack. What Jack was aided by legumes?
Oh.
Mr. Curran.
That was Jack who... climbed up the beanstalk.
Yes, that's the Jack who was aided by legumes. And what Jack was pleased by a droop? I'll spell droop. D-R-U-P-E. Mr. Curran.
A little Jack Horner sat in the corner and so forth and stuck in his thumb and pulled out a plum. A plum is a species of fruit that the botanists call a droop.
It's not a droop.
Yes, it is.
D-R-U-P-E.
Well,
a group.
I know you don't eat.
Well, there's more than one kind of droop. That's right. It's a fruit that consists, as Mr. Kieran indicates, of a fleshy outer part around a hard stone. What Jack was a pickpocket? Mr. Levant.
The one by Dickens. Isn't that true?
I don't think his name was Jack, though.
Well, change the question.
Hang around. No, the one
Fagan.
I'm...
Jackie came to my house and stole a leg of beef.
But it wasn't. He wasn't a pickpocket, really.
Mm-hmm. Jack Fagan, wasn't it?
More like burglary there. Jack of Diamonds from Waterboy. Remember that? Mr. Adams?
Mm-hmm.
Help
you
me out.
You robbed my pocket.
That's it.
You robbed my pocket of silver and gold.
I guess we'll lose you sooner to Bing Crosby sooner or later. All right, that gives us 2 out of 3 and sends us on to this one from John Montgomery of Miami Beach. On the streets of what cities would you have found these children? I'm going to name the children for you. The first is a set of kids named Paulie Haggerty, Davy Cohen, and Weary Riley. What city would you find them?
Is that Hemingway? No.
No?
No.
Miss Smith?
Sounds like Chicago.
Do you want me to accept that as your answer?
Well, yes.
All right, I will. Chicago is right. Yes. And it's from James Farrell's novel, Studs Lonergan.
Yes,
those are some of the youngsters in that novel. I sort of forget what you said, Mr. Levant.
I didn't say anything.
Didn't you? I thought you said something.
Oh, I said, was it by Hemingway? Because
yeah.
There's a man named Cohn and the sun also rises.
Yeah, but it's a common name.
But I only asked. I didn't answer.
Guess he's got me there. Here's another set of youngsters. Jack Dawkins, Charlie Bates, Tom Chitling. What city would you have found these boys in? Jack Dawkins, Charlie Bates, Tom Chitling. Miss Smith.
It sounds like London.
Do you stick to London?
Yes.
So you're good at this stuff, Miss Smith. That's right. London is right. There, and Mr. Levant, that's what you were searching for. They're Fagin's gang of young pickpockets. And one of them, by the way, was named Jack. Jack Dawkins.
Jack Fagan, I insist.
Jack Dawkins is right. How about 3 kids named, lovely names these are, Spit, TB, and Angel.
Dead end.
Mr. Levant?
Dead end.
Dead end kids in what city would that be?
New York, on 52nd Street, I think.
How are things doing around 52nd
They're,
Street?
We're in Universal Pictures afterwards.
They must be elderly gentlemen by this time, the dead end.
They're
kids.
Divorced, I think.
Really? Divorced? Well, I guess that's all we have time for. Thank you, Miss Betty Smith, for helping us with the fun this evening. Tonight, the H.J. Hines Company has paid out $57 in war bonds and stamps, and that, as you know, means 1 set of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Next week, we'll have our 2 regulars, Mr. Kieran and Mr. Adams, and we present a rather special pair of guests. We're going to have with us Senators Lister Hill of Alabama and Joseph H. Ball of Minnesota, who are 2, as you know, of the famous quartet of senators now working hard for post-war legislation. And I think we're going to look forward to their visit. Remember, send your...